Welcome to the Code Newbie Podcast. I'm your host, Saran, and for our very first episode, I'm so excited to have Carlos Lazo on the show. If you've been part of our Code Newbie Twitter chats every Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, then you definitely know Carlos. And now you get to actually hear him. Carlos, you want to say hi?
Hey, everyone. Thanks so much, Saran, for having me on your podcast.
No problem. So I wanted you on the show, not only because you're awesome and you've been so supportive in helping people learn to code, but because you have a really interesting mix of coding experiences. You studied computer science in school. You've worked as an engineer for 5 years. You've done recruiting and hiring yourself for tech positions. But even with all that, you still decided to attend a programming bootcamp. And now you're a web developer at Time Inc. Do I have that right?
That's exactly right.
So let's start at college. What did you do there?
Yeah, so in college, I studied computer science and computer engineering, and I did a lot of fun things with robotics and artificial intelligence. So there was a lot of electrical and mechanical engineering mixed in, but most of my work was with circuitry and making things move.
So you did an undergrad and a master's?
Correct. So during my first full-time job post-college, I did a master's part-time in electrical engineering. That's correct.
Yeah, I have none of those. Instead, I made the very smart career move of majoring in English and psychology. Now, while there has been a ton of debate on how important a CS degree really is, a lot of us who don't have a technical background are still really intimidated by people like you who studied computer science in school. So I want to know, do I need a CS degree to be a good programmer?
So the answer to that, in my opinion, is I don't actually think so. I think that a computer science degree will help supplement your knowledge and will help you understand things at a different perspective. So much like a lot of things, it all depends on how you decide to use it. So remembering back to college, a lot of the things that I learned there were experimental and they weren't necessarily practical or realistic. And although I do tend to use some of the knowledge I learned back then in my everyday job, it's not really a whole lot. And we have this thing called the internet now where we can look these things up as well. So as a web developer, I'd say it's useful for sure, but it's not necessarily a requirement.
Yeah, I hear the internet's pretty awesome.
That's right.
So how has a CS degree helped and maybe even hurt you as a working developer?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So I think certainly in terms of the helping portion, I can be analytical with things. At the same time, that's also the weakness. Or it can hurt me. So I tend to take a lot of precautions when I design things or before I develop them. So I start thinking very, very early on about things like complexities or how will this web application operate with large sets of data. Where I think in web development, a lot of the idea behind it is just to get things out as fast as possible and to push product. So there are times where it's been very useful to have that mindset. At the same time, it's also gotten in my way before. So I've been trying to learn to take a step back and to kind of squash that analytical side of me for a bit, just so I can get into the weeds and start programming faster.
So sometimes it gets in your way. How so?
Actually, I think we can use the Code Newbie website as an example. So I think when I started working on that with you, Saran, a lot of the things that I mentioned up front were really unnecessary. And I noticed that I started over planning things. And there were parts of the code base that we could have refactored, but that wasn't necessarily the most important part. And I think you really helped teach me about getting things live, getting things up on the web for people to see, and not so much tapping into our own opinion as developers because we're biased to the products we make, but getting other people to use them and asking them in particular, what do they find useful?
So what's the difference between what you learned in school and what you need on the job, especially since you mentioned earlier that a lot of what you learned in school was more experimental and not necessarily practical? Tell me about that.
Yeah, so I think that things in school give you a solid foundation as to how things may play out, but on-the-job training is certainly the best. And I think the main reason for that is because it's incredibly unpredictable. So you can go through scenarios in college or experiments through homework and projects that show you things like how to debug, but that's not ever going to compare to what it's like being woken up at 3 a.m. when your web app goes down and your company's losing money as a result of it. So I think that as a developer in the real world, the reality of what you're doing and the potential impact it will have will teach you a lot about how you need to develop your software, what sorts of things you need to look out for early. And you use those things, those mistakes that you make, to get better each time you do it. So I think that college is a good foundation, but the experience really comes with your first job. And a lot of that is based on the failures that you encounter.
So you got your CS degree. What happened next?
After my CS degree, I looked for some programs directly after college where I can continue my education. So I worked for 5 years at a company where most of their products were related to the Army, Navy, and the Air Force. So I was working for a government contractor. And that was really cool because this company gave me the opportunity to see a lot of different sides of engineering through a rotational program.
So I have this memory that you used to program missiles. Did I just make that up?
No, so kind of, but not really. So the teams that I was working on at this company were developing software to counter infrared missiles overseas. And the systems that I primarily worked on in my time there were used to defend our troops. So there was a really cool aspect of engineering involved there. And I did a lot of things in the electrical realm and also in software. So the sense of urgency, as you might imagine, with those particular products was really great. And a lot of people out in the development world now say things like, man, I can't push deployment for 2 weeks, or even I catch myself saying things like that, or why does it take this long? Software releases at my last company would happen every 9 months to a year. So think about that for a moment.
That sounds crazy intense and really badass. Did it feel as badass as it sounds?
It did at times. I think that it was also really stressful just because of what we were doing. So, and on top of that, for the first 3 years, I was doing night classes for my master's. So it certainly was intense. And working with a variety of different teams and different kinds of engineers was also very intense. So I think one of the biggest takeaways for me from that particular experience was I got to work with a lot of different people across a lot of different disciplines. So right now at work, I tend to work mostly with software engineers. So we tend to speak the same language. But at my last job, I would be speaking to mechanical engineers, electrical engineers, and just a variety of different sorts of people.
You know, I like that because when I first looked into technology, I didn't appreciate how large tech was as a field. Even the difference between working in hardware and software just didn't mean very much to me. It was all one big scary thing. But it sounds like you started in hardware and then you moved into software. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's a correct statement. The sort of projects that I was working on were really a mix of the two. And I think one of the terms used to describe that sort of technology is embedded software, where your software has to communicate with hardware, where they split the work depending on what you're doing. So yeah, that's a correct statement.
So after doing all that, what made you decide to focus on web development and ultimately go to a bootcamp?
Sure. So that particular area was a very focused market. And I realized that after 5 years, if I didn't make a jump or do something else at that particular point, I was going to be doing that pretty much for the rest of my life. So I started looking on Twitter and seeing what else was out there, and the world of web development became very obvious to me. So as to why I did a bootcamp, I felt like taking a calculated risk. I wanted to do something a bit crazy. For folks that know me, you probably know that's kind of my personality. And I originally grew up in the New Jersey, New York City area, but this previous job was in New Hampshire. So slight bit of difference. So I was looking up code schools and I honed in on the Flatiron School in New York City. So I felt that doing the program immersively for 12 weeks, I think was just a wonderful experience in of itself. And devoting a part of my life to just full-on programming sounded more appealing to me than doing that while I was still at my job. So I think that was the reason why I did the bootcamp.
One question that we get all the time, especially on Twitter, is about bootcamps. You know, is it worth it? Which one do I go to? How do I know it's a good one? Especially because they all claim very similar results. Everyone gets a job and makes, you know, whatever the salary is. but what were your expectations going into a boot camp?
I think it was a little tough for me at first. I had done my research and looked at what boot camps were available for me. And certainly talking to some of the alumni from previous classes helped a lot. In terms of my expectations, I think that the instructors were very important for me. The passion that those instructors conveyed to the students was also important. And the networking in particular. So because I was moving from one part of the country to the other, I really wanted to build a family around this organization and not just have it be 12 weeks of learning and growing as a technical person, but I wanted to grow socially as well, to expand my network and to meet like-minded, motivated people that also really wanted this. So for me, it was a bit interesting because I came from a tech background and I was going to a programming boot camp. And a lot of times, most of the stories you hear are from people that have liberal arts backgrounds. And that's not a bad thing. That's awesome. I'm so happy to see that that's the way the school, that's the way the school looks for individuals. But I got so much out of the school in those 12 weeks. It was just awesome.
That's a good point. Because most of the people who go to a boot camp like that are looking to make a career change.
Right.
From something that has nothing to do with technology. But you came in with 5 years of experience in engineering. Did that make it easier to learn a new framework and a new language like Ruby on Rails?
It actually did. So one of the things that you'll notice, or that newer folks to programming and engineering will notice, is that the learning curve at the very beginning with languages can be very tough. And even for me, it can be tough as well. But the more you do it, you'll start seeing repetitions and patterns across the different languages. So I worked in C++ and Java quite a lot before. So those languages have very similar constructs to what Ruby has. And then when you tack on things like computer science, that persists or is the same across the different languages. So for me, Ruby syntax was very different, but having programmed before made it way easier. The difficult part for me was the web aspect, so learning the Ruby on Rails framework, because that was 100% new to me. But again, your brain programs itself to try to understand this stuff. And again, the more you do it, the better you're going to get at it, and the faster you will pick it up.
What was the best and the worst thing about how you learned to code?
Yeah, so I think the worst thing for me, because I started so young, I think I started programming when I was 12. I was doing Visual Basic, was that back then, there really wasn't a support community at all. There really, really wasn't. And the internet wasn't nearly as pervasive as it is right now. So the worst thing for me was probably that I did most of my learning by myself. Now, the best thing was my career refocus in terms of coding. I decided on web development to be the next step of my career. And the reason why that was the best for me was because the community is just the most wonderful thing I've ever been a part of. I've only been in it for a year, but I feel like it's been much longer. And the amount of connections that I've made, the things that I've learned and that I continue to learn, and just the availability of resources is just absolutely fantastic.
For people deciding how they should learn to code and thinking about a bootcamp, what should they consider?
I think that folks trying to make that decision should think about what they want to get out of the experience. So for my classmates at school, some folks wanted to start their own companies. Some folks wanted to find new jobs. Some even just wanted to learn. So it's really all about what you want and what you're looking for. And in some cases, how fast you want to get it. Because a 3-month sacrifice is what I called it. 3 months is a long time. And for those 3 months that I was in my boot camp, I pretty much shut the rest of the world out. And that was okay for me because I was doing something amazing. So you have to ask yourself if you're willing to make that sort of time sacrifice. And not for nothing, it's also really, really intense. You're programming from 9 a.m. sometimes till midnight or even later, depending on how much you put into it. Because how much you put in is how much you get out, in my opinion. So you'll have to come to that determination on your own. And you have folks like me and Saran that you can ask if you have any questions.
I don't think people appreciate how intense it is until they're actually there. I've had people tell me, oh, I'm planning on working a part-time job or even a full-time job while I'm doing it. And you can do that. but you're not going to get as much out of it as you could. And it really feels like a waste of the thousands of dollars that you're probably paying. So I think it's a great question to start with is it worth the sacrifice? Because if you're going to do it, you should go in all the way.
That's right.
So the biggest question for bootcamp grads is, will I find a job? Right? That's usually the goal, getting a job as a programmer. What was it like for you to find a job right out of a bootcamp, especially after spending only 3 months on a new language and a new framework?
Yeah, so I think it was a really interesting experience. I think that different companies had different expectations for what they were looking for in terms of a developer. So I know that for a fact that my current company was looking for engineers that had previous engineering experience for the reasons that I stated before in terms of ability to learn and that ramp up period. I think it was a bit interesting too because a lot of places that I interviewed at had different ways of interviewing. Some had coding exercises. Some had live coding exercises on Google Hangouts or via documents or even pair programming. So I think that was really neat. But another part of it too that I think is important is the school does help you or the bootcamp does help you. But I think that as graduates, it's important to keep control and to take control of your own career. So I know that I started doing a little bit of research near the end of my bootcamp just to try to understand what was out there, what companies existed here in the New York City landscape to try to figure out where I wanted to go. So for me, the big decision was startup or big company.
That's actually the next thing I wanted to talk to you about, because recently on Twitter, one of our favorite code newbies, Christina, asked us about what languages and frameworks are used at bigger companies. And I think the concern there was that a lot of the languages that are great for beginners, like Ruby and Python, were mostly used at startups. But you work at Time Inc., which is a pretty big company, and you're working in Rails. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
So what projects are you working on?
Yeah, so at my company right now, I'm working on a total of 4 different Rails applications across that support multiple brands at my company. So at my company, we have names like Time, Sports Illustrated, People, and a variety of other different areas that have magazines and have websites and web components. So my different applications support the web and mobile components of those particular brands. So we have web applications that do things like allow people to upload their own photo content to our sites. We have things that track user profiles across our sites and allow for personalization. So it gives users the ability to bookmark things on our websites, to vote in polls, and to do things like that. We also support big websites like myrecipes.com. So we have a Rails backend that supports all of the data that editors publish and push to that particular website for recipes, menus, and different aspects of their database. So I think those are the 4 big things that we use on my team. We have other Rails teams at the company that support other websites like foodandwine.com, travelandleisure.com, etc.
You mentioned earlier that the biggest difference between school and the real world was the consequences. So what are some of the consequences of messing up or bringing a website down in your role?
Definitely. So I think that some of the big ones for sure are you end up losing customers. So we have had this happen a few times at my company where a database goes down or a web server goes down. And we have an emergency response team set up for that because having a website goes down equates to losing ad revenue. So a lot of big companies use ad sales across their sites and they generate money for us. So whenever our site is down, we can't generate money from those websites. In addition, we end up getting nasty emails from customers saying, I can't log in, your mobile app isn't working, and you start losing people. And those bad reviews permeate to other people. And some of our products do have competitors, so we want to make sure that the experience that we provide our customers is top-notch and that it matches the particular brand that's using our services. So it ends up being kind of a big deal. And it's a big coordinated effort to make sure everything stays up at all times.
Yeah, those nasty emails are tough.
Yeah, they're really tough because you want to do well, but sometimes mistakes happen or code is deployed that shouldn't be there and things break.
So when you say that you end up not making money, not getting that ad revenue, How much are we talking?
So across my brands, for my particular Rails applications, I think we service about somewhere between 20 to 25 million API requests per hour. So that's a lot. If a site goes down for around an hour or two, that's about, it could be anywhere between $10,000 to $25,000 of money lost.
Wow.
So just based on the amount of people that visit our sites and that use our services. So it is certainly not pocket change.
Not my pockets anyway.
No, not mine either.
So with only 3 months of training and having so much responsibility, you must have done a lot of learning, maybe even most of the learning on the job. And I'm sure you've had a few sink or swim moments. Can you tell us about one?
Yeah, for sure. So I'd say my first sink or swim moment was on day one of my job. And don't get too scared, I promise. It's probably not normally like this, but on day one of my job, I was put on a project where the primary database store was MongoDB, which is a NoSQL solution. So at my boot camp, we learned a particular database type called SQL, which is very standard, but it doesn't tend to be used very much in production environments just because of the way it scales. So I was put on a project where we were migrating from one particular SQL-based database kind to MongoDB. So day one, I was put on that project. I showed up and they're like, great, you have 1 week to learn what MongoDB is. And I'm still learning it. I'm still understanding how it works and how to architect things of that nature. But one of the things that's really important about starting any new job, even outside of web development, is to not be intimidated. As engineers and as developers, we're paid to be frustrated. At least that's how I think about it. But at the same time, the way I think about it, we're always in school. We're always learning. We have to be learning. And I'm not discrediting any other profession because they're all amazing and they all require skill. But as an engineer, as a developer, you are always learning. So when someone told me, learn Mongo, learn MySQL, learn what Redis is, all right, bring it. That's my take on that.
I really like the whole paid to be frustrated idea.
Yeah, it's just a much better way to think about it. And I'm not saying it's a good thing to be frustrated all the time, because you need to definitely celebrate the moments of success that you have throughout your projects individually and with your team. But thinking about it that way, it makes it easier. So if you think about it this way, if we're being paid or we are being contracted for our services as web developers by different companies, or maybe it's our own company eventually, if these things were already built, there really wouldn't be a need for web developers. So there's a lot of innovation behind this kind of engineering that requires our skills. At least as far as I know, there isn't a system to automate the creation of custom web apps just yet. So I hope to be employed for, you know, at least another decade.
Me too. But I like that, because I don't think that when people first learn to code, they understand that it's supposed to be frustrating and it's supposed to be painful. And that's okay, right? Because if you don't understand that your job is fixing things that are always broken, it's really easy to internalize that frustration and just conclude that you're stupid or you're not good enough or you just weren't meant to be a programmer. So understanding that part of your job is to be frustrated is really important.
Right. And that, I'd say that gets easier the longer you do this too. And we're all human. And at the end of the day, leaving a day or leaving work on a day where you didn't get something to work the way you wanted to is really frustrating. I've had that happen more times in my life than I can count. But sometimes you just need to step away, recollect yourself, try to figure out what the problem is, and then just go back at it the next day. And I think that you as an individual and as a part of a team, if that's what your workflow is, I think you need to keep yourselves in check like that. You have deadlines and you have pressure, understood, but I want to say that you will get better at understanding what that level of stress is and that you're going to learn eventually to be okay with that frustration. It is a part of the job, especially when you're doing something you've never done before, but be consistent, get through it. You're going to get better. It takes time.
I want to switch gears and talk about your experience hiring developers. How many interviews have you done over the years, and what type of roles have you hired for?
Yeah, so I would say that in my years, I've probably done close to 100 interviews. And the reason for that is I was leading the recruiting initiative for an entire year for my last company. So I got to see a lot of different interviews. And we were interviewing for mechanical, electrical, software, and systems engineers. But I would say the majority of my interviews were for software engineering positions.
So what do you look for in a developer?
So number one for me is passion. So what I mean by that is I will ask developers questions like, what are your favorite podcasts that you listen to? And if they don't say Code Newbie, I immediately discredit them.
Oh, definitely.
But we continue. We continue on. So I care about things like, what podcasts do you listen to? Do you develop outside of work? I ask developers, or I ask people, to see if they're opinionated. I ask things like, do you have a particular framework you really like? Have you programmed anything outside of Ruby? And depending on those answers, I'd like to have a conversation with the individual just to see whether they're opinionated or not. And I think that's really important for two reasons. One, when you're starting new projects or as you continue to build on existing projects, being opinionated and trying to understand why you would do one thing over the other is really important, because depending on which path you choose, they have different consequences end game. So I think that's important. And secondly, it's a matter of personality too. I'm going to be spending literally most of my day with you at work. So I have to make sure that we can gel well together, that we have a similar mindset, that you're here for the right reasons, you really want this job. And yeah, I think that's what I really, so personality, I think, and that motivation, that drive is my first part of the other answer to the question. And then secondly is technical acumen. So I'm hiring for a development position. I want to make sure that you can contribute from day one. So depending on the sort of position we're hiring for, whether it's a junior engineer, a mid-level engineer, or even a senior engineer, we're going to ask you different sorts of questions. So with my company, we ask general programming questions about Ruby and Rails. And then we do a portion where we do some live coding, where we ask you to write methods that do certain things. We ask you things like, what's wrong with this particular piece of code and how would you refactor it, just to see what your sort of programming sense is. And if we like you, we hire you.
I think the most intimidating part of an interview is still the technical questions, especially when you're applying for that first programming job. What's the best way to prepare for those?
Definitely. So I think that mock interviews are by far the best way to prepare for them. So I know that I've done a few mock interviews with other folks that wanted practice. And I think getting the direct feedback right after as to how you did, I think is really, really key. And you have folks like me that would be more than willing to help you out with that in terms of the behavioral components, so the personality-based questions, and then certainly the technical questions. So you also have to make sure that depending on what you're interviewing for, that you're set with that particular language. So my team is specifically hiring for Ruby. We had a developer come in that had Ruby on their resume, but they started writing code in Python. And that was a big no-no. So I definitely wouldn't recommend doing that. So know your audience and make sure you understand what you're interviewing for, because that's really important.
What's the one thing people get wrong in an interview?
Ooh, good question. And I'm going to try to give you a good answer. So being honest about what you don't know. So there have been times where I've asked questions and I get an answer back that starts with a bit of hesitation, but the interviewee feels the need to answer every single question. And I think that is one of the biggest mistakes that people make. Because one, experienced interviewers will know when you're not telling the truth or when you're just saying something. And perhaps even worse, some interviewers will continue down that rabbit hole, latch onto the answer, and start asking more about it, up until the point where it's a bit obvious that you don't actually know what you're talking about. So I think it's really important in interviews to be incredibly honest. And if someone asks me something like, when's the last time you worked with Elasticsearch. My response is, I'm sorry, I don't know what Elasticsearch is. Would you be able to tell me what that is? And that spin at the end, the I don't know, could you let me know, is so important because it tells the interviewer that you've acknowledged the fact that you don't know something and that you're willing to learn it. So my recommendation to interviewees is just be honest. If you don't know something, say so. We're not going to immediately dismiss you or say we're not going to, right? Because there's so much to learn at any given time. No one's going to know everything. It's impossible. And we certainly don't expect you to know everything. So be honest.
I use that technique all the time. It's amazing. The whole, I don't know what you're talking about, but I'd love to learn more. Can you tell me where I can learn more about this thing that you're saying? It's come in handy, not just in interviews, but in life. It is great. And it gives the other person a chance to talk about themselves, which is what everyone really wants to do anyway.
Right. So interviews should be two-way conversations. I understand that the interviewer is trying to understand what you know, but I'd say the best interviews I've held and that I've had personally have been the ones where it feels like a conversation, where it becomes evident that you know what you're talking about. So we get more to the what kind of person are you and do you fit our needs really well? So definitely.
I've had a lot of conversations with people applying for that first programming job, and their biggest concern is that they have no leverage. They're a beginner, they don't know enough, they just don't feel very employable. So what happens is they feel obligated to take positions at companies they know isn't a good fit, or they take salaries that are a lot lower than what they could get even as a junior, or they end up taking those fake programming roles that have creeped up where they tell you you're going to do a lot of coding, but your job is really just customer support and maybe you'll get to write some CSS.
Ooh.
But it's so hard to evaluate yourself and know what to wait for, what to look for, and what you're worth. So what should you fight for in that first programming job? And what can you wait until maybe the second or third to get?
What's worth fighting for is finding a company that suits your needs. So I know that, as you mentioned before, there can be a sense of desperation or urgency. And a lot of places like programming bootcamps say we have 97% placement, 100% placement. They throw out a lot of impressive numbers, but those numbers don't necessarily equate to the time it takes for someone to get a particular job. So for me, with my experience and with the bootcamp, it still took me a month or two to get the job I wanted because I had been interviewing with a lot of places, but they didn't sit well with me. So my general guidance to anyone is if something feels off about a job or if you don't think the interview went well and you get an offer, do not feel obligated to take it. I would much rather spend more time looking for a job that feels right to me then take one and then leave a few months after, which professionally is not a good idea. So my ultimate recommendation in terms of what's worth fighting for, fight for something you believe in. Fight for a product and a team which you know is going to help you continue learning.
So on that first job, it sounds like finding a place where you know you're going to learn and be supported and encouraged in your learning is really important.
Exactly right.
And I like what you said about when you feel like something's off. Because in the times I've taken a position where something didn't feel quite right, you know, I didn't know exactly where the feeling was coming from. But in my gut, it just felt off. And every time I've taken a position with that feeling, I've always regretted it.
Yeah, so I think listening to that inner voice is really important. I've literally walked into interviews before myself looking for jobs. And within just a few minutes of hearing the other person talk, it's just like, nope, thanks. I'm going to finish this as a courtesy, but there's just something that doesn't feel right. And I think one of the most important things too, since you brought it up, Saran, is as an interviewee, make sure to ask questions about the company. What's the culture like? What sort are you going to be working overtime? What's the expectation of you as a developer at that company? Because the last thing you'd want to have happen too is to be completely blindsided by needing to work 60 hours a week to push product out. Or as you said before, right? Am I going to be expected to be a developer 100% of the time? Or am I going to be doing customer service? Which isn't a bad thing. It helps you cross train, but you need to make sure that the expectations you have match what you actually end up doing.
I really like that. What are the expectations of you as a developer? That's a great question to ask companies.
Right. Absolutely. Because every company is different. Every company's development workflow is different. every company treats developers differently too. So it's not something that you should guess on. And you're being grilled with questions, grill the interviewer back. It's well within your right, and you should take advantage of that.
So before we do picks, I'm going to ask you three rapid-fire fill-in-the-blank questions. Are you ready?
Yes, let's do it.
Number one, the worst advice I've ever received is?
Fake it till you make it.
Ooh, how come?
So I have a really big problem with that advice because fake it till you make it allows people to get to a part in their career where they don't end up being as strong as they can be. And it makes you sound like you know what you're talking about without actually knowing what you're talking about. So this kind of loops back to that honesty thing I mentioned about interviews. If you don't know something, use it as an excuse to learn it. It will make you a much better developer. And as you start climbing the ranks of companies, it will make you that much stronger. If someone continues talking about server-side work and you know nothing about it, go learn it. Don't pretend like you know what you're talking about, because that will get you into trouble.
I think I agree when it comes to being honest about what you know and you don't know. But I think there's a time when fake it till you make it is really important in terms of your confidence, right? So faking confidence until you feel confident is definitely a strategy that's worked for me. So is there a time and a place where maybe that saying is helpful?
Yeah, so I think if you're put on the spot at particular meetings and people ask you questions, I think it could be useful there. But I generally try to err on the side of caution with it because I'm decoupling my confidence from what I know. So what I mean by that is me as an individual, I'm confident in what I know. And I tell myself that. That is my ethos. That is a part of who I am. And my confidence is not correlated to what I know in the tech realm because I'm still learning. So I've grown accustomed to the fact that I just cannot be hard on myself. I cannot. And other folks at my company, I've been very honest with them and said, I've only been doing this for a year. I really appreciate the patience. I really appreciate your support. And that's kind of what it is. So for me, that confidence doesn't even come close to what I actually know because I keep them separate.
I love that idea of decoupling your confidence from what you know. I need to work on that.
It takes time, trust me. And I'm still learning how to do it. It is really hard.
Okay. Number two. My first app was about
informing people of street sweep rules in New York City via text and Twitter. So me and my team at our boot camp in week three built an application called New York City Street Sweep. And this was a Sinatra application, which is a web framework in Ruby, where a user could enter their cross streets of where they lived in New York City and a Twitter handle and a phone number. And we would text and tweet at them the street sweep rules and the street sweep rules for that particular location in New York City. So it would tell people when they needed to move their car.
Is it live somewhere? Can we check it out?
I don't think it's live right now, but I can make it live.
Oh, can you make it live?
I can do that. I'll send you a link once it's up.
Yes. Ah, so excited. Number three. One thing I wish I knew when I first started to code is?
One thing that I wish I knew was that frustration was part of the game. And that, more importantly, to piggyback off that, learning takes time and it takes a lot of practice. So for me, being consistent about my learning is really, really important. And even to go one step further, do not be hard on yourself. I've been seeing a lot of tweets over the past few months about people saying, I'm never going to get this. CSS is too hard. And it is really difficult, but you are doing yourself and your intelligence a disservice when you say things like that. Because remember, we were all newbies at one point, and we still are. And I think that one of the really important things that I've started adopting in my life that I think, I don't remember who I heard this from, but I always want to make sure I'm new at something because having that thirst for learning is really, really important. So to recap, being frustrated is okay. Be good about your learning and do not be hard on yourself. That is not going to help. And you have a community of people that will support you in that because we're all going through it.
Okay, so I definitely asked for one thing you wish you knew and you gave me three things you wish you knew.
I couldn't help it.
You're the first guest and you're already breaking the rules. So now let's get to the picks. I have two picks I'm really excited to share with you. One is technical and one is not. The first is ThoughtBot Style Guide, which I absolutely love. It's a guide for programming in style, as the README says. And the idea is that ThoughtBot has a lot of opinions on how things should work and how they should look. And especially as a beginning programmer, it's hard to have opinions about things without the experience. So this gives you a great starting point. It has style guides for naming, for Sass, CoffeeScript, Backbone, Ruby, for many of the tools that you've probably heard of and you might be learning, so definitely check it out. The second one is definitely not technical, it's much more artsy, and it's a collection of photos that I love called Traffic Lights by Lucas Zimmermann. So he took these long exposure photographs of traffic lights in Germany, and the colors are just so gorgeous, and it's a simple idea, but it came out absolutely beautifully, and I'd love for you to see it. Carlos, what'd you get?
Sure. So I have two programming ones and then one fun one. So I'll start with sharing something from the Mozilla Developer Network, and it's a really, really cool site for CSS. So I've been working a lot with CSS recently. I'm trying to get better at it. It is still foreign to me. And this particular page has a list of all the different CSS properties that exist that you can use, and it has really cool examples. So remember, you can't spell success without CSS, so be sure to check this one out.
I'm going to be sure to remember that the next time CSS makes me angry.
I'm so sorry, I just said that. Moving right along, we have a cool Sublime Text 2 and 3 plugin that I found recently called Git Gutter. What this one does is that while you're coding using Git, or if you're part of a Git repository with Sublime, you will get visual cues on the left side of Sublime of where you added, deleted, or changed lines. This for me is really cool because as I'm working across different files on a big Rails project, it's really cool for me to see in line what's changed from my current diff to the previous diff. So check this one out. It's really cool for your workflow. And the last thing I want to share, there was this really, really cool Kickstarter about a month or so ago that got funded. It's called The Coolest Cooler. And this thing is absolutely ridiculous. It is a reinvented cooler that has things like LED lights, a USB charger, a blender, speakers, just so many amazing things are attached to this cooler. And the goal was $50,000 on Kickstarter. And the total pledge that was submitted was $13.3 million. So it was epically awesome. It was funded, as you can imagine. I'm getting one. So I'll be sure to let you guys know when the party happens.
And get you tweeted some pictures too.
You got it.
And that's all we've got for the very first episode of the Kunibi podcast. Thank you, Carlos, so much for joining. And thank you all for listening in. Please let us know what you think. Send us a tweet at CodeNewbies or email us at hello@codenewbie.org. And we hope to catch you next week.